The fact that there is a discovery and publicly release of zero-day vulnerabilities when there's no mitigation in place, like what we saw with Avanti, like that is a huge concern. Because our net defenders, the people who are doing and patching large systems, they are exhausted. They are seeking prioritization. They need help to better understand what they have to protect against. And if we're talking about vulnerabilities or releasing things with no mitigation or patch in sight, that is hugely concerning because that is just causing a huge distress across the entire cybersecurity communities.
Well, welcome to another episode of Mandiant's Defenders Advantage podcast. I'm your host, Luke McNamara. My guest today is Morgan Adamski, who leads the National Security Agency's Cybersecurity Collaboration Center. Morgan, great to have you here today.
Thanks, Luke. I'm really excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, there's a million things I want to pick your brain about, but where I think it probably makes the most sense to start is hearing a little bit about your role and the mission of your organization within the larger NSA mission and what you guys do.
Yeah, so NSA's Cybersecurity Collaboration Center is about 3.5 years old now. It was stood up in December 2020, right at the break of SolarWinds, one way to kick off public-private partnerships, let me tell you. But the Collaboration Center is really meant to be a forcing function for how NSA is operationalizing our intelligence and our technical expertise when it comes to cyber threats with the private sector. So, you know, historically, when we've went to share information with the private sector, we've typically leveraged our interagency colleagues to get that information out. We've used different mechanisms because it was just not something that we did. We didn't really engage outside the fence line. But what we recognized in the cybersecurity arena is that things are moving too fast. In order to be timely and actionable, you've really got to deliver the information as quickly as possible. And when people have questions about the information, you have to be available to answer them. And so really the CCC is an organization that's physically outside the fence line, but it also primarily operates in the unclassified domain.
Well, as someone with some proximity to SolarWinds, being at Mandiant at the time that happened, I can understand the necessity for that. And I think certainly something that those of us in the private sector are grateful for, the increasing growth, I think, of the partnership that we see with government that really has grown a lot over the years, you know, from when I first started in threat intel and, you know, anything cyber, even on the defensive side, was really less discussed, I think, you know, in the open. And it was, you know, maybe more kind of research coming out of the private sector. But it's been amazing to see just how much there is out there, whether it's the detail that you see in indictments and, you know, advisories that are coming out. Thinking about some of the trends that you guys are focused on this year and things that you're communicating, you know, with private sector about, I think maybe a good place to start is actually what we saw last year. And I think from our perspective, you know, we saw a really record rise in the amount of 0 days being exploited. You know, a continued trend there. I would say a particular focus on edge infrastructure, VPNs and the like. What do you make of that? What's sort of your takeaways from what we saw last year with respect to zero-day exploitation?
So yeah, completely agree, right? Rise in the leveraging of zero-day vulnerabilities is something that's super concerning. It's not even just that. It's the fact that we saw rapid exploitation happening after those zero-day vulnerabilities were discovered or publicly released with not necessarily the right mitigation in place to protect against them. And people were just capitalizing on the fact that the POCs were out there, that they were able to exploit as quickly as possible. And so, you know, that just made life as a defender really hard and exhausting, which I think we can all relate to in the cybersecurity community. One of the things we think about edge devices and the targeting of edge devices is this has been happening for years, right? It is something people have talked about, and the fact that anything that's interconnected is going to be targeted. But I think what's really changed in the conversation, especially over the last year, is a broader understanding of intent. Why the adversaries are potentially targeting those devices, what they're exploiting, and the networks they're trying to get into and for what purpose. And I think that's really what's changed the conversation and the fact of when we think about, okay, how do you protect yourself from things like the Chinese cyber activity, the things tied to things like Volt Typhoon, Bronze Silhouette, however you want to reference it. And so I think that's one of the key points that we've really focused on the last year. And that's because of what you referenced earlier, is the fact that we have that government and industry conversation where industry has the great visibility on all the activity happening against their networks and their customers. And the government really hopes to bring to the conversation the intent as to why it's happening and talk about that publicly.
So you referenced Volt Typhoon, and I think that's an interesting one to touch on. Again, thinking back to some of the larger themes or conversations that emerged last year, what is the sort of significance of that group? For folks who aren't familiar and they hear, okay, just another Chinese APT cyber espionage group, what's the aspects of that group's activity with what we've seen to date that really make them a concern?
Yeah, the concern is the fact that, you know, I talked about the fact we have a broader understanding of their intent, and the intent was pretty much laid out at the public hearing you heard a couple weeks ago. I mean, it is pre-positioning on U.S. critical infrastructure. It is not for the purpose of intelligence gathering. It is to be burrowed into critical infrastructure networks for the purpose of potentially leveraging that access to do something destructive or disruptive at their time of choosing. And so that is the concerning aspect of that activity, and the fact that it's really hard to find. You know, everyone references the living off the land techniques that those adversaries are using, that Volt Typhoon is using to get into those networks. Living off the land is not new for those of us in the cybersecurity community. It's just now it's something that we really hope that people understand a little bit better, and that there are ways to defend against it, but it's not a silver bullet situation. You've got to deploy a bunch of different tactics, mitigation strategies, investments across your enterprise to be able to protect against it. And it's not going to go away. So Volt Typhoon continues. We continue to find activity. We now reference historical activity and realize that it was Volt Typhoon. And so it is going to be a constant threat and something that we all kind of have to defend against together.
Yeah, and I think that's an excellent point for those who do see this as just another, you know, Chinese APT group. The focus here, especially when you look at some of the targets where they've shown up, not targets that have necessarily intelligence value, but ones that could certainly have a cascading impact were they to be disrupted down the road. So notable difference there than what we've historically seen with respect to IP theft or some of the other operations from Chinese espionage groups.
Yeah, and a lot of, you know, one of the other pieces of this is a lot of net defenders, SOCs, IT teams, they're looking for loud, noisy activity. They're looking for large amounts of exfil coming out of their networks. They're looking for common IOCs that they can tie to this and just say, okay, I found them, I've gotten them out, or I've null routed or shut those devices off. It is not that simple. There's no massive amounts of exfils. There's no easy IOCs associated with a Volt Typhoon. And I think that's one of the key aspects that makes this very difficult, because we need companies, the big ones with the massive threat teams, and really small companies with no cybersecurity expertise to be able to defend against that. And that requires a whole different range of conversations.
I think it's a great point. And especially once you get into the topic of critical infrastructure and even some of the sectors that we know were impacted here, you know, some of the sectors are not as well resourced historically when it comes to security, but they play very important roles in our daily lives. You think about water utilities, transportation, et cetera. And so I think that this is certainly something very important to kind of, you know, flag for the larger attention of these critical infrastructures.
Yeah. And, you know, we reference them. I know our CISA colleagues reference them as target rich, resource poor. Right. And so for those particular companies, I think one of the key things that we've tried to emphasize, and I know has been messaged quite frequently recently, is that there are a number of services, things that even our commercial partners like Mandiant provide that are available to these companies that maybe we don't do a great job of consolidating into one list, but they're out there, and a lot of companies can benefit from these cybersecurity services in different ways that will help to protect them a little bit against some of this activity.
So we talked a little bit about Zero Days. We talked about Volt Typhoon. Moving into this year, into 2024, what are some of the themes and trends that you're following or you're keeping an eye on? Again, anything from could be just TTPs, like living off the land and seeing how threat actors, not a new technique, but, you know, maybe increasingly adopt that, to maybe kind of larger geopolitical trends or some of the things that the big four are doing with respect to threat activity.
So operationalizing vulnerabilities, right? The fact that there is a discovery and publicly release of zero-day vulnerabilities when there's no mitigation in place, like what we saw with Avanti, like that is a huge concern. Because our net defenders, the people who are doing and patching large systems, they are exhausted. They are seeking prioritization. They need help to better understand what they have to protect against. And if we're talking about vulnerabilities or releasing things with no mitigation or patch in sight, that is hugely concerning because that is just causing a huge distress across the entire cybersecurity community. So that is something that we are trying to determine what's the best way forward, not just in the government, but with our private sector partners. How do we create ways to determine what's being exploited first and then release that to people so they know what to focus on? I think that's one thing that we're going to look at in the next year on how do we improve that kind of minimizing that gap. The second piece, you can't get out of a conversation on cybersecurity without talking about artificial intelligence and generative AI and the role of LLMs. And, you know, I think the one thing for us in the cybersecurity community is there is huge opportunity because a lot of us have been using AI for different purposes as part of our regular business practices and in different ways. But how do we take that technology and leverage it even more as a cyber defender in some of our workflows and processes? I think that is something that we want to make sure people recognize because people always want to talk about the risks associated with AI. There are also extreme benefits. You just have to use it in a safely and secure manner, right? So on the risk side, you know, NSA recently set up the AI Security Center, which is also part of the Cybersecurity Collaboration Center. And that center is really focused on providing best practices on how you do safe deployment of AI networks and systems for those people who want to leverage the technology, as well as releasing information in conjunction with companies like you guys. I know you guys released a report earlier from a Mandiant perspective. There was a recent report on cyber threats as well on what actors are looking to use AI, LLMs in particular, and how they're using it to their benefit. Because if the offense gets faster, so does the defense. And so we got to kind of focus on that effort. The last thing that we're really focusing on, to your point, is not necessarily a geopolitical issue or an adversary issue. It is just the fact that we've got to upskill a significant workforce to keep up with this technology, the threats, and just the things that we need to deal with on a regular basis. Every cybersecurity professional gets burnt out. It's just a way of our business. And so we've got to create healthy workplaces that people want to be a part of and can continue to use their technical expertise for good, but also grow the next generation of workforce that's going to have to continue to deal with these threats. And so those are probably the primary things we're focused on.
Yeah, with respect to the AI component, obviously we do a lot. There's a lot of thinking around that here. I think the speed piece that you mentioned, though, is very important because that is really an area, and the workforce development and workforce uplift, because I think it also gets back to how do we scale the resources that companies already have, and they may be limited, but I think when, you know, you look at some of the things that people have creatively looked at using LLMs for, like being able to write YARA rules very quickly or decode PowerShell strings, I think there's very basic tasks that are able to kind of speed up, you know, those kind of more toilsome functions. But if they result in faster speed on the part of the defender, then we're helping, you know, close that gap with the adversary. And I think that's always a piece we could certainly do more around.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things from a, you know, definitely looking at AI, also AI workforce, right? There's a specific skill set that comes with understanding and assessing LLMs, understanding how to secure them. I mean, a lot of it is basic cybersecurity, but then there are specific unique backgrounds that we're going to need to grow vastly to be able to assess and contribute to this conversation as it relates to the technology. So I think it's definitely something we're interested in. For the workforce piece, you know, one of the great initiatives that I wish would get more attention and more focus, but I think it is under CISA's Secure by Design and Secure by Default initiatives, is memory safe language and secure coding as part of college curriculum. I think that's something that we're really passionate about here at NSA, is how do we get some of those core classes in place? So, you know, hopefully we can have secure code from the beginning and we're not necessarily dealing with all the same issues we have today.
One of the other trends, you know, that we certainly saw a lot of last year, I would say kind of a notable uptick from 2022, and it'll be interesting to see how it develops this year, is the problem around ransomware and multifaceted extortion. We're recording this just on the heels of a disruption of, you know, one of the more prominent groups, you know, in affiliate networks around ransomware, Lockbit. It seems like it's a space that's always in flux. You know, there's certainly a lot of you know, creative ways in which adversaries in that ecosystem are always looking to kind of monetize their access, find new ways to extort. And it's always been in flux, you know, for years now. Any thoughts on where we could see that go next? I mean, we just, you know, we've seen obviously a lot of different variations of the flavors of extortions, but should we expect more creativity coming down the road from these adversaries? Thoughts on that?
In any aspect of cybersecurity, as you start to take disruptive or actions against these adversaries, they change their TTPs. They're going to figure out a way that they want to have the upper hand and have the advantage. So I think we're definitely going to see them evolve. I mean, we know now that our adversaries, especially in ransomware, are watching what we're doing and they're learning and they're trying to get a little bit more sneaky or stealthy in their techniques. The good news is that kudos to our FBI colleagues and our Department of Justice colleagues. We are just as creative in this space now. We see a lot of people forward leaning to want to disrupt what our ransomware actors are doing. So I think that I see a toe-to-toe fight happening, and I think the U.S. government is looking to have the advantage, and I think they're doing a great job of it.
Shifting gears a little bit to talk about kind of what we've been talking about, you know, at this point in general, which is, you know, the work that you're doing in communicating to industry, the things that you choose to prioritize and flag. And this is something that I think we spend a lot of time thinking about as well with things like, you know, our blog or this podcast, things that we're putting out to the general public or industry. Everyone, to your point earlier, is, you know, overly tasked in this space, right? People are dealing with alert fatigue. How do you think about the overall process of prioritization of threats and making sure that you are flagging when there's something like Vault Typhoon, hey, this is a threat you really need to take seriously, and maybe it's different than other previous threats that we've encountered in the past, but also approach that with, you know, that sort of overtaxing in mind, the fact that, you know, security teams are tired or they're dealing with alert fatigue. How do you wrestle with all that?
It's not an easy thing to wrestle with. I'll tell you that. But because you want to make sure that you're telling people as much as you can, and they have all the information and they're armed with it to do the best that they can to defend their networks. But from an NSA perspective, our goal when we're communicating publicly, which let's all be honest, is something fairly new for us, but we're doing a lot more these days, is that when we're talking about a threat, when we're taking the time to be out there and really emphasize the importance of people paying attention and the mitigation guidance that's applicable, it's because we know it's that significant. We really feel that when it comes to prioritization, the key behind that is context, right? Context provides the justification for urgency and prioritization. We want to be able to make sure industry, commercial partners, people that own networks understand that if we're telling you to do X, Y, and Z, it's because of Y. And it's because we have nation state actors who are intending to do something malicious to your networks that could have a real impact, right? And so our goal is to always provide context where it provides value for prioritization so that people can make those decisions in the right headspace. Because we know that on the private side, you know, you guys wrestle with a lot of different differing priorities from different customers and geopolitical situations and things you have to balance. And so if the only thing that we can provide is context, whether at the classified or the unclassified level, we need to do it so that you feel that you have the right information to make the best decision.
And do you think about that also from the perspective of actionability of, you know, not just the threat that you're communicating about, but, you know, if it's something like IOCs or something, again, like Vault Typhoon, where you don't have as much of that sort of, you know, tactical IOCs, you're describing more behavioral components, you know, thinking about what those end users would be looking for from government, you know, from your organization to help them hunt for, find, mitigate that activity.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, I've been in the government my entire life when it comes to cybersecurity. So full disclosure, when we talk about that. But I can only imagine how painful it is to be told something about a threat against your networks that is only in the classified realm where you can't do anything about it. And there's nothing actionable for you to kind of put on your network or do something with. So we try to ensure that as much as possible, we have actionable information at the lowest classification possible for you able to do something to protect yourself when we share that information. Vault Typhoon, you know, to just go back to that specific scenario, is really hard because we talked about the fact that it's living off the land. There's not a lot of tradecraft. There's not malware necessarily. There might be infrastructure associated, but I think we've also referenced the fact that their infrastructure is constantly changing because they're using home routers and SOHO networks, and they're massive and they change within minutes and hours. And so that's really hard to track as well if you don't have the right telemetry. And so I think we try to share as much as possible, but what I have found most beneficial when you talk about Volt Typhoon is not the one-to-one sharing or the transactional sharing of an IOC. It is the conversation that private sector companies are driving with their customers, with each other, with the U.S. government, and saying, I've seen some of this. Does this make sense? Does this fit into your puzzle? And we're building the picture together. It's really not one side or the other.
So does a piece of this involve obviously reaching, you know, declassified audiences, but then also in some cases bringing in to the classified space those entities out in industry, private sector, critical infrastructure?
It's both. Absolutely. You've got to be able to share information at the unclassified level, but sometimes we need to have extremely, you know, not extremely, we need to have classified conversations to be able to say, okay, here's all the biggest picture. We need your help. What's your expertise? How do we break this down? What would be the most beneficial to you at the unclassified level to be able to action and go out to your customers? And so it's a methodology that we're still building, but I think we've gotten a lot better at it over the last couple of years.
So I think we've seen, I mean, to that point, you know, a variety of different means that the government uses at its disposal, and you could even say global governments increasingly with respect to both bolstering the defender side and then also thwarting the adversaries. You know, there's legal actions, there's disruptive actions that can be taken, there's information sharing. And a piece of this, I guess, gets into, you can get very actor specific. Certain things are more impactful to certain actors or even the types of activity. But are there certain techniques, certain tools, certain levers that you've seen to be more successful than others, maybe at disrupting adversary activity or, again, bolstering the capability of the defenders?
Yeah. So, you know, you've been in this business a long time, right, Luke? So you know that when we talk about cyber options, ways to disrupt adversaries, it's not necessarily cyber to cyber. And people tend to get sucked into that conversation that if I'm going to respond, it has to be cyber in kind. What I really like about what we're currently doing when we talk about cyber adversaries and countering them is that we are using all the levers of power and all the different capabilities across both the government and the private sector. And so what that turns into is conversations about cyber diplomacy, right? How do we work with our international partners so that if we know that adversaries are also targeting them, how do we make them aware and cognizant of what's happening so that they could potentially take action, right? It's a coalition of coming together and kind of having a common understanding. I think that our legal arms and the Department of Justice and FBI using rewards for justice and using indictments is another cool tool that's really been used heavily recently that I think is great when you talk about specific actors, both in the Iran and the ransomware space. And then also, just when people think about disruption, they like to think about this big bang effect. I will tell you that disruption at times can just be writing a detection signature and pushing it to an endpoint platform that enables an actor to no longer be able to operate or pull back their operations because they realize that their malware has been detected or removed. That's a disruption operation, and that's something that commercial partners and industry partners can do and have done on their own, maybe with context with the government or maybe not. So there's all these different things that are happening right now in different aspects, and all of them are disruption. And I think they're happening all now almost concurrently. And that's a really great impact to have on an adversary.
Yeah. I mean, speaking, you know, from my perspective, I think one of the useful things, probably not their, you know, primary purpose, but with indictments, obviously justice is trying to build a case and everything. But one of the things we found to be very helpful with those is when those come out, there's always more details in there than what we knew. So there's pieces of this we were able to say, ah, that links to this, you know, particular cluster we were tracking. But getting more of the even organizational backend picture of what that looks like and how maybe different clusters we were tracking separately are tied together, that can be very useful for us to kind of, you know, weave the picture together and, you know, better understand the adversary. So I think some of these components can be useful for a number of different purposes. And I think also you mentioned, you know, cyber diplomacy, seeing the increasing amount of, you know, when there's been announcements around attribution for a particular widespread event or a set of activity that's occurring. I think about some of the sandworm stuff a couple of years ago. It's been interesting to see kind of the growing coalition of countries that are, you know, have the right personnel and are trained and comfortable enough to talk in those terms and understand the attribution piece. And that sort of leading to a global collective response is really interesting to see. So we're kind of at the closing, you know, time here, but any other kind of final thoughts, again, around things that you're optimistic about, things that you're tracking, adversaries we should be aware of, trends going into 2024?
I'm really optimistic about the fact that what I've seen over the last 3 or so years as the director here at the CCC is that a ton of private sector partners have stepped up and willingly shared information, their insights, and their expertise on adversaries, on how to secure networks, have proactively offered free services to those small businesses that can't protect themselves. I think that type of collaboration and work and incentives, it's phenomenal and awesome to watch from a cybersecurity professional perspective, because it is really neat that everyone wants to step forward and come together and really defend against those adversaries that want to take advantage of our US critical infrastructure. We're doing it in a way as a collective. And I think that's the most important part.
Excellent. Well, let's end it on that note, because it's not often that a talk around cybersecurity ends on a positive note. So when those opportunities emerge, I'm going to take those. Morgan Adamski, thank you so much for your time today and great conversation.
Yep. Thank you so much for having me, Luke.